Okay, well, thanks really to all of the panelists. I think these were some really stimulating comments, and there certainly isn't enough time to comment on everything, so I'll just really limit myself maybe to a couple of items. I very much liked Dr. Verhoeve's point about the World Health Organization should be seen as the most important security organization, although one can perhaps argue that maybe all of the major UN agencies, in a sense, are also security organizations, and the International Labour Organization, I think, was founded early in the 20th century, very much in mind with the events of World War I, and very much in the preamble, I believe, stating that creating stable employment situations was essential for social stability and therefore also for security. So I think some of the thinking is actually not that new, but I think we need to sort of remind ourselves of some of our earlier learned lessons. Another important point that he raised, that Dr. Verhoeve raised, was this whole issue of the uni and multipolar world. And I very much agree that we need to continue to work with, in effect, sort of like-minded alliances between governments, NGOs, businesses, and so on. But I'm not sure that, in the end, that really obviates the need to, in a sense, sort of reform, redesign the UN, come up with an international system that is more workable than the current one seems to be, because even if we look at what some of these like-minded coalitions accomplished, landmines is one example, but the other one, I think particularly here in The Hague, the International Criminal Court, I think when we look at what happened, yes, the court is now a reality, but we also know that the world's most powerful country has not signed on to it and actually actively opposes it. So we're still back to the issue of how do we make this work on a global level? How do we bring everybody in? And so I think we can make first steps in a very innovative way by various kinds of partnerships. But we still need to figure out the fundamentals of global governance. I think that is a task that remains. The other item real quick that I want to address is, I should say it would really be great if one of our co-authors, the one for chapter 4 actually would be here, because we could have a really great debate, I think. I'm not an expert on food and water issues, so I think what I will do in response to some of the comments is maybe just focus on one particular angle. And to me, it seems to me what we need to look at, if we were to go with a high intensity, with a high input agriculture in parts of the world that have not gone down that road, particularly Africa, apart even from the questions of that system alone, the implications of it, we also need to look at the social repercussions, the social structure repercussions. What happens when we, in effect, go with a high-intensity agriculture that is not in need of very many people, not many farmers? What do we do with people? We already have, I think, a situation in many developing countries where because there is even not enough land and water, or because land distribution is highly unequal, more and more young people do not feel that they have much of a future in rural areas. So this adds really to the dynamic, to the momentum toward people migrating towards cities. It adds to the urbanization pressures. And clearly we have not come anywhere close to figuring out what do we do in urban areas, how do we better provide jobs, social infrastructure, how do we improve the governance of urban areas. So if we don't pay attention to those kinds of repercussions, I think we will just really shift some of the security or stability related problems elsewhere and just find ourselves again confronted with a different set of issues, but really issues that are just follow on consequences of some of the policies with regard to agriculture. I think I'll just leave it there. Thank you.